Good afternoon. My name is Leslie Goldstein, attorney registration number 24658, and I represent Mr. Gay. I briefed a number of issues, and I would like to use my time wisely. I wanted to start on the suppression of the 41-1 motion that was filed by Mr. Gay. I believe that the state fundamentally misapprehends our argument. To begin with, we did, Mr. Gay did object and argued that the prerequisites under Diaz were not established, specifically that there was no probable cause asserted in the affidavit or any reasonable suspicion supporting perhaps something less than probable cause. And
for the burglary or for the sex assault?
For the sex assault. So the 41-1, what happened is Detective Wimmer had this amorphous Byron Gay lead, which was placed in the HA file, and that essentially lay dormant. In 2009, Mr. Gay picked up a burglary case, and Detective Wimmer approached the lead detective in the burglary case and said, "Hey, go get a 41-1 in your case because I think we can link it to these cases that I have that are unresolved." And so as a result of that, that detective prepared a 41-1 in the 269 case.
In the burglary case.
In the burglary case, correct. Of significance, though, was that there was no mention that this 41-1 was essentially used to obtain the saliva sample from Mr. Gay for the specific purpose of testing the DNA in these three cases that are...
It was also relevant in the burglary case, was it not?
Well, yes, but not to the extent that I think the state sets forth in the briefs. I was also appellate counsel on that case. And while it's true that eventually there was a hat that was tested in the burglary case, that evidence in and of itself was not overwhelming. There were certainly many other pieces of
corroborating evidence.
It was corroborating, but I mean, in the burglary case, for instance, there were eyewitnesses who said that they saw Mr. Gay in the residence. There were also, Mr. Gay was contacted shortly after being viewed in the residence a short distance away, and he was actually followed by three separate eyewitnesses.
So what you're saying is the taking of the swab sample in the burglary case was pretextual?
Absolutely.
So what?
Well, I think that's one of the concerns I have with the people's brief is they talk about, so what, this is inevitable discovery. That's actually not what the inevitable discovery doctrine...
But pretexts also don't make a difference.
Well, the inevitable discovery doctrine says that in order to take advantage of that doctrine, that the police actually have to be seeking lawful means to obtain that evidence. And that actually never...
But counsel, I think you are misunderstanding at least what I understand to be the people's argument. It doesn't necessarily rely on inevitable discovery doctrine. Put that aside for the moment. In the burglary case, they had probable cause to believe the burglary had been committed, and you don't disagree that there was reasonable grounds to believe that Mr. Gay had committed the burglary. So there was probable cause to support the order issued in the burglary case to get the saliva sample, therefore it was lawfully obtained. And so what case law do you have to say once you lawfully obtain evidence, you can only use it in that particular case in which it was obtained?
Well, the cases that I cite, Judge, talk about how you've got to establish the Diaz criteria, that we are submitting...
Right. And you agree in the burglary case, the Diaz criteria were satisfied.
I do, but the problem is that the detective in the burglary case did not actually even do testing on the ski mask in the burglary case until subsequent, long after there was testing done in the sex assault cases.
So what?
Well, I think that's disingenuous and is actually one of the cases that I cited, Casavas, that's basically creating a fait accompli, that they jumped the gun. So they had this amorphous belief, which was never developed and actually relates to another issue that I have that they talked about developing this Byron Gay lead, yet we never had anyone come testify. We were never able to cross-examine this unnamed parole officer. We don't know if it's male or female. We don't know anything about this parole officer who had the suggestion that perhaps Mr. Gay was responsible for this one sex assault. And so it's undermining the purpose of 411 when they actually were circumventing getting a 411 in the current cases to use it in a different one. And I think the problem with this is then you're looking at the end result as opposed to the proper procedures that we need to.
But if it was proper in the burglary case, aren't they required to put it in the database?
Well, my
didn't they get the DNA results out of the database?
It's my understanding that they took the saliva sample, and based on that saliva sample, then they matched it up to the other DNA in the current case. So
But don't they have to take the sample and get a DNA profile and then upload that to the database, which could be used for all manner of further criminal prosecutions, including the sexual assault case?
Well, I think that also begs the question, which the state raised, that sure, it was uploaded, but I think there's many cases that have been before the court where there have been numerous defendants who've had numerous prior felony convictions. Some of them are actually sitting in prison, and it's many years later that their DNA is actually linked up. So I don't believe it's this automatic fait accompli that they would automatically match a DNA just because it's based in CODIS. So
let me ask you this on the 41.1 issue. There seems to be case law from both the state Supreme Court and this court which suggests that 41.1 is an order under 41.1 is only necessary if the suspect is not in custody and you need to bring them in temporarily to conduct this identification procedure. But in this case, the defendant was in custody after being lawfully arrested in the burglary case. So why does 41.1 apply at all?
The cases that I reviewed on 41.1, I would refer to People v. Collins, which dealt with DNA that was taken from a defendant who was originally contacted in Missouri.
Right, but that case that didn't have a 41.1 order, at least initially, was by consent that he gave his saliva.
That's true, but what happened is, and he did consent, which is why I didn't mention it, because it's really not talking about the 41.1. The other case I wanted to talk about, or that references essentially, is People v. Luna Solis, which is 298 P3rd 927. And that was a case where the defendant was arrested and had a pending case in Arapahoe County. There were also investigations going on in Denver County. And I think there was some discussion. Judge Wheeler in Arapahoe County ultimately issued an order and suppressed the saliva sample that was taken while the defendant, I believe, was in custody in Denver County because under ostensibly a discovery of Rule 16 violation, because counsel had not been notified of that. And so there's a line in the case that says, notwithstanding compliance with 41.1.
I guess I'm not seeing how that responds to my question about why 41.1 applies at all if the defendant is already in lawful custody.
Because I think the purpose of 41.1 is that we are submitting something to the court for judicial review, and before we're allowing a search or a seizure of bodily fluids from a defendant, that we subject that to judicial review. And ultimately that.
But where does that requirement come from?
I would suggest Davis v. Mississippi, which is 394 U.S. 721, 89 Supreme Court 1394, which is a U.S. Supreme Court case from 1969. And based on that case, we then promulgated 41.1, which is these additional protections that we provide to criminal defendants.
Well, what about the recent case in which the Supreme Court authorized the Maryland system, which authorized collection of DNA from anyone arrested for a serious crime, so that before any, there's no other protections or any other requirements necessary to collect DNA. You just have to be arrested for a serious crime.
Well, I mean, it seems to me then the court is saying, have we vitiated the whole purpose of 41-1?
And well, I'm talking about the U.S. Supreme Court here.
Well, I would submit that 41-1 still has viability, and we're still requiring the prosecution to submit to the court for judicial review to see that the Diaz factors have been met before we're going to sign off on a 41.
But the nubbins of your argument is that this is pretextual. This was a scheme. This was a conspiracy between the detective who was investigating the three unsolved rapes and the officer who had him in custody for an unrelated burglary. Is that right? And that's basically
absolutely
what bothers you.
Absolutely.
And my question goes back to, we have drug enforcement officers stopping people for broken taillights and searching vehicles.
I don't.
Now, do you have any doubt that that's pretextual? I had an assistant attorney general arguing with me on that point, but that's a pretextual stop?
Well, as a defense lawyer, I believe that's pretextual.
I know, but it doesn't make any difference, does it?
Well, I believe that there's U.S. Supreme Court cases that say that you can initiate a traffic stop based on a minor traffic violation.
The fact that a homicide detective would not normally make a traffic stop and a drug enforcement officer would not normally make a traffic stop has nothing to do with whether the evidence that results from the search is admissible. Do you agree with that? And if you agree with that, what difference does it make that the taking of the sample was pretextual in an effort to solve the rape cases?
Well, again, I think this gets back to what is the purpose of a 41-1. And if we're going to...
My learned colleague says the purpose of a 41-1 is to take somebody into custody to get a sample. Somebody who's out free, take them into custody and get a sample.
Well, I don't exactly agree with that. I think the purpose of 41...
So you think he's wrong?
Well, you don't have to answer that question, but I can quote you People versus Osorio Bahena, quote, Crim P 41.1 permits a court to issue an order requiring a person to be taken temporarily into custody for non-testimonial ID procedures. That's the purpose of the rule.
Well, I believe in addition to that, Judge, we're also saying we're submitting to the court for judicial review to see that those three Diaz factors have been met.
But in Diaz, the ID procedures happened before he was arrested. So that's quite different.
That's true, Judge. Nevertheless, I think in this case, Mr. Gay was in custody. He objected to his saliva sample being taken. There was a hearing. It was ultimately taken pursuant in the 09 CR-269 case. And so I would submit that, yes, it was pure and simple pretext. I have a few minutes left. If possible, I'd like to move on to some of my other issues.
That's fine with us.
Originally, I had not planned on arguing the consolidation or the 404B, but in reviewing the briefs, I think it's very important that the court look at the three different sex assaults that were alleged. They were vastly different from each other. The three victims were vastly different. There was nothing in scope, motive, or intent that was remotely connect these three cases. The first case, which happened in 1993, was exceedingly brutal. It was alleged there was physical violence perpetrated on RB. There were kidnapping. She was left in a closet, locked in a closet. Those things were not present in the subsequent sex assaults in 1995. So we have the case in 1993, brutal. Importantly, no weapon used in the 1993 case. Then we have the two cases in 1995. There was an allegation of a weapon in one of the cases. The different
isn't the fact that they share the DNA trump all of this?
I don't.
I mean, you just had witness or two get on for each case to say what happened. And then you bring in the expert, and the expert says the defendant's DNA was found in the victim. I mean, what difference does it make?
Judge, People v. Barris, 232 P3rd 264, which is a case from this court, talks about that consolidation is permissible if all of the offenses are same or similar character based on two or more acts of transactions that are connected together or are part of a single scheme or plan. That does not talk or reference at all DNA. And we've got, because what we're really concerned about here is that the jury would be convicting on propensity or be so abhorrent to these sex assaults that would be likely to find guilt based on that.
Let me ask you this. Was there any other identification evidence?
No.
The only identification evidence is the DNA.
Absolutely, because these three individual victims were only able to give essentially very vague descriptions.
Right. So the only thing that ties these cases together is the DNA.
But that's not what Barris says, is that you actually...
What bothers me about applying that whole area of law here is that we have three random stories and one nugget of evidence that ties them all together. And nothing in the trial makes sense until the expert testifies that the defendant's DNA was found in all three victims. That's it. Isn't it?
Yes. I understand.
The fact that they were similar or dissimilar are not going to be taken into account by the jury. They're going to look at the DNA evidence and say...
Well, I disagree with the court because if we take...
I'm not the court.
If we take that the next step and we look at what happened in the instant case, if that were true, why did we have Tim Garner going all over town taking aerial photographs? This is where the defendant lived here. This is where a victim lived here. This is the path. We have a video. That it was all that they needed other evidence to get in. It was all speculation. And so it's not just the DNA evidence. It's not the end all and be all of the case. And what the defense also argued is the Colorado Supreme Court Kaufman, which talked about the importance of looking at the allegations of the prior bad acts and what the relevance was to each other and to the current facts. Because if we don't have that kind of relevance, then it's outweighed by undue prejudice. And certainly I think that was the case here.
But in this case, the trial court found that a knife or sharp object was used in every one of the assaults. Entry was gained by forcible means. The victims were forcibly undressed. He asked for money. The accused or the rapist asked for money, which supplies some sort of motive. Don't all those facts tie the cases together, irrespective of the DNA?
I think there's case law that talks specifically about modus operandi and that there's something so signature and unique about a way a defendant commits the crimes that is inexplicably or inextricably linked together. And I think, with all due respect, what the court just talked about are really general. There was a sex assault, but was it anal? Was it vaginal? I disagree. I think in the 1993 assault, there was no weapon. There was no allegation of weapon. And in the HA case, the jury actually rejected the assertion that a weapon had been used. So the jury disagreed with the court. And certainly, I think those pieces that the court just referenced are not in and of themselves such a signature MO that it was linked to the defendant.
Thank you.
Thank you. If it's acceptable, I'll reserve.
Sure.
Thank you.
Afternoon, may it please the court, William Kozlowski, registration number 37824 on behalf of the people. I'll start with the suppression issue since Ms. Goldstein did. As this court has observed, the operative question is whether defendant's DNA sample was lawfully taken in the first place. Defendant does not challenge that the affidavit was improper or was proper under 41-1 as to the burglary. And that is the end of the inquiry. Fourth Amendment is not concerned with case numbers, or what offense the investigating officer happens to be investigating. The U.S. Supreme Court precedents in Bond, Wren, Graham, and the Colorado Supreme Court precedent in Weymouth establish that pretext and the officer's motivations are simply irrelevant to whether evidence should be suppressed or not. Defendant essentially objects to the comparison of his DNA with DNA derived from samples taken from the victims in the sex assaults. However, there's no infringement on defendant's rights by undertaking such a comparison. The government can test lawfully obtained evidence as they see fit. There's no requirement for individualized suspicion or probable cause as to each crime. And similarly, with regards to your question, Judge Navarro, this case was framed as a 41-1 case below. I believe the affidavit said it was a 41-1, so the people argued it under that because that's what the defendant challenged, or actually didn't challenge at the 41-1.
But go ahead.
The purpose of the rule is to get someone into custody temporarily in order to get identifying evidence. Because if you had probable cause to arrest them otherwise, you don't need to get them in custody, obviously.
So if that's the case, then did we need a 41.1 order at all in this case, in the burglary case, to get the saliva?
No, if someone's in custody, then it's generally governed by Rule 16-2A1, which just says that court can require a defendant to give a similar sample without additional probable cause. And that's the Osorio Bahena case that you discussed, that he challenged that on 41-1, but he was in custody. And this court, or a division of this court, said that he wasn't challenging it under Rule 16, so it didn't matter at all.
Okay, thank you.
Also, the defendant argues that, or implies that, the police should have gotten probable cause as to the sex assaults, or a 41-1 as to these sex assaults, but there was no reasonable basis to suspect that defendant did it. That's why they got the DNA. It was essentially his name was in the file, let's test it, and it came back as positive. So there was no way they could have gotten a 41-1 as to these cases at that time.
Was there a conclusion in the investigation, or at least a theory of the investigation, that these cases, all three, were related?
Yes, they had matched the DNA sequences in the three cases. They just didn't know whose it was. And also, as to the even assuming this was a pretext in that matter, they ended up using the evidence in the burglary. So essentially, defendants arguing for a case-specific suppression, which I've never seen a case like that. And also, she points to that they didn't test the mask. What happened was they got the defendant's DNA, got the sequence, and then right away they could look to see if it matched the sex assault, because those tests had already been done. It took a little while to test the mask, which then was matched. So I don't even think that's evidence of pretext, even if it was.
Unless you agree that the fact that it may have been pretextual makes no difference.
It's well established that that just does not matter. I think the court has observed that already. If the court has no further questions about the suppression issue, I'll turn to the joinder issue. The trial court joined the cases because it concluded that the evidence in one would be admissible in the other two. And the basis under 404B was that it was relevant to intent, identity, modus operandi, and common plan or scheme. And each victim described a black individual as the perpetrator who had a particular method of carrying out a sexual assault. The perpetrator identified isolated women at night, broke into their homes. In two of them, he used a knife. In the other one, he essentially used his hands as a deadly weapon.
So on that point, the way I read the trial court's ruling, the court noted that a knife or a sharp object was used in each of the attacks. You're saying that's wrong?
Yeah, I think the court misspoke that if you read if you read the people's motion, it was just that essentially a deadly weapon was used in the first, and then similarly a sharp object was used in the other two to overcome the victim's will to get her to do what the perpetrator wanted.
Let me ask you the same question I asked defense counsel. Why do we have to go through this? I mean, the DNA evidence connects everything.
I agree.
And so it seems to me that any error would be harmless because nothing comes together until the DNA evidence.
I don't disagree with that, Your Honor.
Well, do you agree that nothing comes together without the DNA evidence?
No, I think they're tied together otherwise.
The question I thought was, if
the court was wrong in its evidentiary ruling, is it harmless? And I would agree with that, given the DNA.
Mr. Kozielewski, did the trial court rely on 1610.301 as well as 404B?
I don't know if the court did at the hearing, but I know the people cited it in their motion to consolidate. So I think that would implicitly include that subsection.
The SPOTO criteria apply to both the statute and the rule, is that correct?
I would say that's an open question.
Okay.
I think under the rule, it says are you talking about Rule 8, Aaron?
No, Rule 404B.
Oh, yes. I'm sorry. Yes, it would.
Sorry, I wasn't very clear.
Sorry, 404B. Yeah, 404B and 1610.301.
So the same analysis.
The same analysis applies. Takes place, yes. And I think going to your question, what ties them all together, particularly to identity, is the perpetrator used some form of the phrase, where is your money, or where is the money? And that was a fairly distinctive.
I'm sorry, you said?
During the assaults, he would assault the victim and then say, where is your money? He would use that, not that exact phrase. I think he said, where is the money? And one, he said, where is your money? And a different one, I think he said, take me to your money. So that was something that brought all the three together apart from the DNA. Also with regard to joinder, it's only improper if defendant shows actual prejudice and the trier was unable to separate facts and legal principles as to each case. Defendant has pointed to nothing specifically in the record. To the contrary, the jury was able to find that the defendant did not use a deadly weapon as to H.A., or that the people did not prove that beyond a reasonable doubt. So that's evidence that they were able to separate the facts.
Well, let me ask you this. Without evidence, all these commonalities exist under 404. That's what we're talking about.
Right.
Okay, but they don't have, they're not in any way tied to something we know the defendant did or has done. There's no identification evidence in all of that evidence. It's just that the same person probably committed all three rapes, but never identifies who that person is until the DNA evidence comes in.
Correct.
Is that correct? So it's not a common scheme and design for identity purposes. It's valuable if you have already convicted the defendant or he's already confessed to a crime where those events occurred.
Well, but that's exactly the point. Each of these proves the other. But
neither of them identify the defendant until the DNA evidence.
But I'm saying my point is the DNA in one case proves that it's the same person in the other. If the jury says, okay, let's go down the charges in this case, and they say, yes, I think this DNA evidence is just indisputable, then when they go to the second one, that same evidence proves the next charge. So that's just another reason.
But we had DNA in all three.
Right, but that, I see what you're saying, that there was no one saying, oh, this was Mr. Gay, but say we, for example, if we only had DNA in one of them, we could prove that that he was the person, and then that one would in turn prove.
I understand that, but that's not here. Here we have...
No, it's even better.
The DNA evidence is the only thing that identifies him as a perpetrator of any of the three offenses.
No, I agree, and that's why, I mean, I think this case proved beyond a shadow of a doubt.
There also evidence that the defendant lived in the same area as all three victims?
Absolutely, yeah.
Doesn't that provide some evidence connecting the crimes to this defendant?
Yes, there was... We had a lot of circumstantial evidence that he lived there, that he was in the area, but as to Judge Roy's question, there was nothing identifying him as the perpetrator at the houses on the nights in question. He generally fit the description that the victims gave also.
Well, if there hadn't been DNA evidence, there was at least a good possibility, if not a small probability, he'd have been acquitted.
Well, I don't dispute that.
Well, I probably never would have been charged.
I would probably wouldn't have been charged.
Because there, these cold cases were going on since the 90s, right?
Yeah, he would not have been charged without DNA evidence. Unless this court has any other questions on any of the other issues, we ask that you affirm the judgment of conviction. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Goldstein, you have 58 seconds.
Just briefly on the consolidation issue, one of the things that the state raised is essentially that the prosecution gave a laundry list of possible evidential hypotheses why we should link these three cases together. And I cited case law, and in fact, there's a Colorado Supreme Court case, Usum v. People, 210 P3rd 458, that we are requiring the prosecution to actually specify a specific evidential hypothesis that did not occur here.
Has anyone suggested that that makes it error to join the cases or to permit the evidence?
Well, what I would suggest is that it shows that the prosecution wanted to link all three and threw in this laundry list.
I can show you records where they give you every reason in the rule.
Well, for instance, in this case, they argued to show that there wasn't consent. Consent was never a defense in the instant case. And in fact, the only issue was identity. So it was never disputed that these sex assaults happened, but who was the perpetrator?
Thank you, Ms. Goldstein. Appreciate your arguments and arguments of Mr. Kozolewski. The case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course.